Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the January 20th, 2023 issue of the Week. This is our first new issue from the Week for the year 2023. The cover drawing this week shows newly elected House Speaker Kevin McCarthy standing at the Speaker's podium. He's got a small gavel in his hand, and closely gathered around him are Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, and Lauren Boebert, and they all have larger gavels in their hands. The headline is Pyrrhic Victory, Why McCarthy Will Be a Weak House Speaker. And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. GOP House Speaker fight begins fractious new era. What happened? The new Republican House majority passed a package of rule changes and established new investigative committees this week as Speaker Kevin McCarthy began delivering on deals he cut to win the votes of 20 far-right members who forced the most contentious election of a House Speaker in over a century. McCarthy, the Republican from California, won the post after a televised battle that stretched over 5 days and 15 votes. He squeaked out a 216-212 win after the last six holdouts, including Representatives Lauren Boebert, the Republican from Colorado, and Matt Gaetz, Republican from Florida, agreed to vote present instead of for an alternate candidate. To win over extremists who attacked him as an establishment Republican, McCarthy agreed to concessions that give him a weak hold on the Speaker's gavel while empowering GOP hardliners. He consented to allowing a single member to call for a vote to remove the Speaker. He also reportedly agreed to put three hardline Freedom Caucus members on the powerful Rules Committee and capped spending at 2022 levels, which could invite battles over hardliner demands to cut defense, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The rules package includes numerous provisions aimed at placating McCarthy's opponents. It makes changes to the Office of Congressional Ethics that watchdogs say will weaken its oversight, gives legislators at least 72 hours to review legislation before a vote, and makes it easier to block spending increases, in part by letting members offer unlimited amendments to spending bills. McCarthy also agreed to hardliner demands that House GOP support for raising the federal debt limit, which will be necessary around August, be tied to major long-term spending cuts. If Democrats refuse to make those cuts, the federal government could default, damaging its credit and causing markets to plunge. Democrats unanimously elected as Minority Leader Representative Hakeem Jeffries of Brooklyn, making the 52-year-old the first black lawmaker to lead a party in Congress. Jeffries warned that the acrimonious speaker vote portended 2 years of chaos under the GOP. Our general concern is that the dysfunction was just the beginning, he said. What the editorial said. McCarthy finally got his hands on the gavel, but at a steep cost to himself and the nation, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. His humiliation by a fringe faction of kooks is part of the disturbing race to the bottom for a rudderless Republican Party whose apparent raison d'etre is raw power and attention. It's hard to see how such a fractious caucus will govern on real issues that affect taxpayers, let alone in a national crisis. The blockade of McCarthy's speakership was a despicable power play by a group of backbenchers, said the Wall Street Journal. Now that he's agreed to allow a single GOP member to force a vote on his removal, McCarthy will be hostage to House members who'd prefer to grandstand rather than do the hard work of governing. what the columnist said. No doubt about it, this is going to be an extremely dysfunctional House, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg. With a razor-thin majority, McCarthy can afford to lose only 4 Republican votes on any measure and has shown members of the Radical Freedom Caucus that their tantrums will be rewarded. They'll likely block normal spending bills, and one or more prolonged government shutdowns is likely. Preventing the economic cataclysm of a federal debt default will require extraordinary measures. Actually, weakening the Speaker might be the best thing for a strong Congress, said Jonah Goldberg in the Dispatch. The House should be an arena where members with varied agendas hammer out legislative solutions from the ground up. In recent years, legislation was drafted by leaders like Nancy Pelosi in private, then presented as a fait accompli to the legislators, expected to hew to the party line. Such dysfunction makes Congress an increasingly unattractive choice for serious people, opening the door to clowns like Boebert and Getz. There are no real moderates in the House GOP, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. Consider the fact that the biggest Republican troll in the House, Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, was on Kev's side from the get-go. A conspiracy theorist who embraced QAnon and claimed Jews set California's wildfires with space lasers, she was marginalized in the last Congress for her fringe views. But she is now McCarthy's golden girl and is ready to graduate to a real power player. It's easy to blame the takeover of the GOP by bomb-throwing disruption monkeys on the gelatinous McCarthy, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. But this is the inevitable fate of a party that has nurtured its aggrieved, paranoid, rage-filled extremists and attention seekers for years. Now Republicans are facing tyranny of the minority in their own conference. And the Burn It All Down faction has all of us, not just a compromised speaker, by the nose hairs. Controversy of the week. George Santos, the congressman who made up everything. We've become accustomed in American politics to a certain level of truth stretching, said Nicholas Fandos in the New York Times. But even in this post-Trump era of alternative facts, it is hard to find a case quite like that of George Santos, the freshman Republican congressman who seems to have fabricated his entire life story. He lied about graduating from a prestigious private high school and 2 colleges that have no record of his attendance. He lied about working for Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. While running for office in a heavily Jewish district of Long Island, New York, Santos, 34, claimed his grandparents were Jews from Ukraine who fled to Brazil to escape the Nazis. But genealogy records show no trace of Jewish heritage. Santos boasted of founding a non-existent animal rescue charity and even once said that the 9/11 attacks caused my mother's death, when in fact she died in 2016. He also didn't disclose that he's wanted in Brazil for stealing a checkbook in 2008 and using it to buy $700 worth of clothes. The serial fabulist has grudgingly admitted to embellishing my resume, but has defied calls for him to resign and was sworn in as a House member last week. Democrats are now calling for Santos' expulsion from Congress, said Ben Jacobs in Vox, but his blue-leaning district would probably elect a Democrat to replace him. And new House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who has a narrow majority, needs every vote he can get. Santos can't vote from jail, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Alongside his more colorful deceptions, Santos may have violated campaign finance law. He loaned his campaign $700,000 last year, but can't explain where he got the money or the millions in assets he claims to have acquired after being twice evicted for failing to pay rent. One of the largest donors to his campaign is related to a Russian oligarch, and for all we know, some foreign power may have bought itself a congressman. Four separate investigations of Santos by county, state, and federal prosecutors are now underway. Santos is morally grotesque, but at the risk of whataboutism, said Kevin D. Williamson in the Dispatch, let's not forget Senator Elizabeth Warren claimed for years to be a Cherokee, or that President Biden has lied about his academic background, been caught plagiarizing a speech, and has indulged in bizarre distortions of family tragedies, claiming that his first wife and daughter were killed by a drunk driver when they died in a simple car wreck, and that his son Beau, a veteran who died of brain cancer, was killed in Iraq. Come on. Santos' litany of shameless lies is on an entirely different scale, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. For that, Republicans can thank the equally shameless liar, Donald Trump, who taught every grifter and two-bit criminal in America to run for office in the GOP with its endlessly credulous base of voters and a whole party of accomplices to downplay any transgression. The epidemic of deceit goes far beyond politics, I'm afraid, said Molly Roberts in the Washington Post. From the outlandish claims of startup tech bros and cryptocurrency gurus to the heavily filtered, impossibly perfect lives of Instagram influencers, our culture is now fully awash in scams, deception, and gaslighting. In one interview, Santos grandiosely called himself the embodiment of the American dream. And for once, maybe he's right. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Hawaiians, who once again led the national life expectancy rankings, according to a new study. The average Hawaiian can expect to live 80.7 years, 8.8 years longer than the average person in Mississippi, which ranked last. It was a good week for baby steps after Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has promoted conspiracy theories such as the claim that Jewish-owned space lasers caused wildfires, acknowledged that she may have gotten sucked into some things I had seen on the Internet. It was a good week for rebranding, with the news that the U.S. State Department will start referring to that nation as Turkiye. Professor Erdog Goknar of Duke University explained that the association of the country with the bird was a denigrating legacy of the colonial era. But it was a bad week for rebranding after the January 6th committee released an internal White House email relaying then-President Donald Trump's desire to trademark the phrase rigged election. Guys, can we do ASAP, please? Wrote Trump's son-in-law and aide, Jared Kushner. It was a bad week for hitting the slopes after ski resorts such as Killington and Stowe in New England were left with almost no skiable snow by weeks of warm temperatures and rain. It was so warm, in fact, the resorts couldn't make snow that would stick. And finally, it was a bad week for marketing. After the TV debut of Power Slap, a new slap fighting contest devised by Ultimate Fighting Championship President Dana White, was postponed after a video surfaced of White slapping his wife twice in Mexico. I'm embarrassed, said White. And a short and other news piece on this page. Classified files found in Biden's old office. The Justice Department is reviewing the discovery of about 10 classified documents at a Washington think tank office once used by President Biden, multiple outlets reported this week. Republicans pounced on the news as evidence of Democrats' hypocrisy, as former President Trump faces a criminal probe for keeping more than 300 classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago estate. Biden's lawyers discovered the documents while cleaning out the office in November and immediately turned them over. Biden said he was surprised that the documents, some of which were marked top secret, were in the old office. They reportedly included intelligence memos and briefing materials covering Ukraine, Iran, and the UK. The title of the briefing this week, The Flaw in New Year's Resolutions. Every January, nearly half of Americans pledge to make big changes. Why will most of us fail? How did the tradition start? New Year's resolutions go back at least 4,000 years to the Babylonians. The ancient Mesopotamian culture is believed to be the first to have celebrated the New Year, but in March, not January, to coincide with the start of the growing season. As part of Akitu, their 12-day religious festival, they pledged to the gods to repay debts and return borrowed items. During the Roman Empire, Julius Caesar established January 1st as the start of the year around 46 BC, and Romans used the month of January to reflect on the previous year and make promises of good behavior. The month itself was named for Janus, the god of beginnings and endings. In the Middle Ages, medieval knights renewed their pledges of chivalry at the end of the year with the vow of the peacock, placing their hands on the noble bird. The first recorded use of the term New Year resolution comes from a Boston newspaper in 1813. Around the same time, Walker's Hibernian Magazine, or Compendium of Entertaining Knowledge in Ireland, satirized the tradition, suggesting that doctors should resolve to be very moderate in their fees, and politicians to have no other object in view than the good of their country. Why do so many people set New Year's resolutions? Surveys show that there is something irresistible and emotionally resonant about the possibility of fresh starts. There's a reason why so many cultures share a vision of the holiday, from the Western New Year on January 1st to the Jewish and Chinese or Lunar New Year celebrations in autumn and midwinter. The beginning of a new year is a milestone that can make people feel unusually inspired and optimistic. And dramatic personal transformations are one of our favorite things to imagine. For most people, resolutions represent the fantasy of perfection, perfect body, perfect life, perfect feelings, without any of the reality, said psychologist Sasha Hines. Almost half of Americans make New Year's resolution every January 1st, but studies show that just 8% stick with them. What are common resolutions? A YouGov poll found that the resolution most frequently made was to exercise more. That was followed closely by losing weight, saving money, and adopting a healthier diet. Those trends have held true for years. A 2017 study found that about 55% of resolutions were health-oriented, with nearly one-third revolving around exercise, and about 10% connected to healthier eating. About 34% were about work or personal finances, and about 5% were social, including a vow to spend more time with family and friends. Why do people fail? Habits are, by definition, deeply ingrained, so even the best intentions aren't enough to turn an idealized future into reality. By mid-February, some 80% of people will give up on their resolutions. Research has found that rewarding habits like overeating or overspending are very hard to quit, and that we need to feel rewarded by and actually learn to enjoy our new habits if they're going to last. Many people also dream too big, as if they will wake up a wholly new person on January 1st. Gym memberships spike in early January, as does physical activity measured by workout apps like Strava. But within weeks, there's a steep drop-off. Analysts call the state, often in early February, Fall Off the Wagon Day or Quitter's Day. University of Chicago behavioral scientist Ayelet Fishbach refers to the challenge of sustaining change after the initial motivation has worn off, but before the end of the goal is in sight, as the middle problem. She says that humans need short-term success to feel sufficiently rewarded to keep going and achieve long-term habit shifts. How would that work? To start, researchers advise break up your goals into smaller, concrete, incremental steps instead of jumping into major lifestyle changes that create great discomfort. Success with little challenges can be rewarding and build confidence and new habits. Being specific is also critical. If you're aiming to be a better family member, you can, for example, set aside 30 minutes a week for a visit or a phone call with a relative. If you do no exercise at all and would like to be more active, start with a 15-minute daily walk rather than joining a gym or buying a $2,000 exercise machine that will soon gather dust. To put money into savings, Fishbach suggests setting a monthly goal rather than an annual one. Our goals may set the tone and motivate us to create habits, said psychologist Carissa Shimura of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, but it's actually engaging in daily, context-specific behaviors that creates a habit. Rethinking the tradition. Since almost everyone who sets a resolution fails to keep it, behavioral psychologists say, it's time to re-examine this tradition and find ways to set goals that are likely to be achieved. Big sweeping lifestyle changes, such as I will avoid unhealthy food and exercise 5 times a week, are hard to sustain, but tiny ones such as no more sweets can also fail if they feel detached from any larger aim. Some psychologists suggest that 3 years of living with the uncertainty and stress of the pandemic has drained many people's emotional resources, making it more difficult to take on major changes. Partly for that reason, the tradition of New Year's resolutions appears to be waning among millennials and Gen Zers, the New York Times has reported. Alex Bowen, 29, told the Times he got tired of always failing to keep his resolutions and of the accompanying negative feelings. He realized he could be more forgiving and gradually work up to his big picture goals. He'd go on an after-dinner walk if he missed a morning run, rather than beating himself up about not sticking to a strict plan. If I don't hit a goal one day, I just try again the next day, he said. It's a much better strategy than waiting until the new year to try again. And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First up, the fallacy in predictions of doom. Climate change is too important a problem to leave to the prophets of EnviroDoom, said Noah Smith. Biologist Paul Ehrlich appeared on CBS's 60 Minutes last week to talk about climate change. And the 90-year-old biologist echoed some of the dire warnings he made in his 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb, even though those predictions were spectacularly wrong. Ehrlich warned of unchecked population growth creating massive global famines in the 1970s and 1980s. Instead, we had exponential increases in crop yields, lower fertility rates, and a steep decline in malnutrition deaths. Ehrlich's simplistic line-go-up thinking that extrapolating current data predicts the future failed to account for human ingenuity. The same fallacy is being repeated by today's degrowther movement, which insists that the only solution to climate change is radical coercive limits on consumption and childbearing. They ignore the blunt fact that two dozen countries, including the U.S., are now growing their economies while reducing carbon emissions. Without dire warnings about climate change, people wouldn't have spent the last 40 years figuring out how to make solar power and batteries cheap. But doomsayers rarely get the future right. Populism's policies are a sham. After years of dominating politics around the world, populism is flailing, said Fareed Zakaria. The U.S. House of Representatives just went through a nervous breakdown in full public view as far-right populist faction blackmailed and weakened new House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. In the U.K., Brexit, perhaps the ultimate populist cause, has wrought economic chaos and havoc within the Conservative Party, which has suffered through five prime ministers in 6 years. Britain now has the most anemic economy of any country in the G7. In South America, both left and right populism has failed miserably. The Trump acolyte Jair Bolsonaro was just ousted in an election, whereas in Chile, 62% of voters rejected a new constitution created by far-left populist politicians. Populism thrives as an opposition movement, exploiting fears and resentment of elites and immigrants. Once populist leaders are elected, the shallowness of their policy proposals is exposed and the public becomes disenchanted. But populism will always reappear in cycles as demagogues seek power by offering solutions to complex problems that are simple, seductive, and wrong. This column's from Brazil. Pelé put our country on the map. Soccer idol Pelé, who died of cancer at 82 last month after watching one last World Cup, was Brazil's greatest ambassador to the world, said Jamil Chade. During his two decades dominating the beautiful game, Pelé charmed prime ministers, queens, popes, and even two U.S. presidents with his warm smile, media-ready manner, and rags-to-riches tale. In fact, as a boy, he learned to play soccer with a ball made of literal rags. He helped craft an image of Brazil as a friendly nation of joy, art, and surprise. This was, of course, mere illusion. The Brazil of the 1960s and 70s was an unjust, racist, and authoritarian country, and Pelé endured monkey chants and other slurs. But he shrugged off the insults and forged a path for black achievement, ultimately earning comparisons to Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali. He even helped restore relations between the U.S. and Brazil when he joined the New York Cosmos in 1975, well after his prime, to help inspire support for soccer among Americans, although he would have to live with the criticism that he was used by the Brazilian military regime. While he eventually retired from play, he never left his post as emissary of the Brazilian people. Through Pelé, we were the best in the world. And we're on to the last word, our in-depth article. Title this week, Getting Snipped. With access to abortion sharply curtailed, men of all political persuasions are seeking vasectomies, said Jesus A. Rodriguez in Politico. One doctor has gone on a nutcracker tour to help them. Inside a black trailer, vinyl wrapped with illustrations of cartoon sperm, the faint smell of burning flesh fills the enclosure. Here in this unconventional operating room, situated in a Planned Parenthood parking lot in Joplin, Missouri, the doctor is trying, with mixed success, to get his patient to relax. "You have to breathe," Escar Guarin, small-framed and slender, tells Denny Dalliance gently. "Take a deep breath." Dalliance, who's 31, drives a truck for a living and arrives clad in black, is trying to keep his cool. Just minutes before, he peeled off his leather jacket and hopped on the operating table. Now he's forcefully exhaling, squeezing his eyes shut, folding an arm over his head, as his partner reassuringly caresses his arm. We're sitting inside the country's only mobile vasectomy clinic, owned and operated by Guarin, who is so committed to getting men to participate in contraception that he once performed the procedure on himself, on camera. He's been practicing medicine for 20 years, and over the past few, he's clocked in more than 3,000 vasectomies. Guarin distracts Dalliance with small talk, asking about everything from his longest trucking assignment, 1,600 miles from northern Texas to Los Angeles, to his dating history. Dalliance is polyamorous, to his thoughts on Elon Musk's electric truck. He's basically the dude that sells monorail in The Simpsons. The tension eases, and then Dalliance is all done. Guarin reaches into his mini-fridge and hands the newly sterilized trucker a can of Fanta as Dalliance heads out to score his post-op reward meal, a veggie burrito from Taco Bell. Outside in the parking lot, Dalliance tells me he'd long ago decided that he didn't want any biological children, period. He doesn't feel like it's right to bring a child into this world, what with fears of climate Armageddon and democratic backsliding. But he says it was a single event this year that prompted him to make the 2.5-hour trek from Kansas City to make sure he couldn't have biological children. The Supreme Court overturning of Roe v. Wade. 20 minutes after the Dobbs ruling in June, Missouri banned all abortions, except in cases of medical emergency. And that, Dalliance says, made the consequences of an unplanned pregnancy much worse. Many women, especially in deep red states like Missouri, responded with immediate alarm to the Dobbs decision, imagining how they would navigate an unwanted pregnancy. Dalliance was among the many Americans who asked themselves what they could do to prevent those pregnancies in the first place. On TikTok, the hashtag vasectomy, which includes clips of women who assemble celebratory care packages for their partners, has been viewed 650 million times. Guarin calls it a vasectomy revolution. In the 48 hours after Dobbs, traffic on his website jumped 250%. In the following month, the number of vasectomies he performed doubled. Though he usually stays in Iowa, this time he's touring Missouri as part of an agreement with Planned Parenthood, parking his vasectomy mobile in clinic parking lots. His 24-by-8.5-foot, 11,000-pound trailer is outfitted with running water, bathroom, and a printer, and festooned with giant letters that read, "Honk if you had your vasectomy." The vehicle has gone viral online as the Nutcracker, a cheeky moniker Guarin's friends came up with, though he thinks the Mythcracker is more fitting. Over 3 days on the road with him, traveling from St. Louis to the industrial outpost of Springfield and Joplin in southwestern Missouri, I see dozens of men of all ages, professions, and political inclinations file through seeking Guarin's fast, effective, stress-free, no-needle, no-scalpel vasectomies. Whether or not they wanted a vasectomy before June 24th, the majority of the 15 men I spoke with said Dobbs accelerated their decision-making process. Some of them saw this as the only alternative, given the unavailability of abortion in some states and the specter of the Supreme Court targeting contraception next, taking a hint from Justice Clarence Thomas' concurring opinion. It makes more sense to take the bullets out of the gun than to try to put a bulletproof vest on somebody, said Jackson Frazier, a 32-year-old from St. Louis, adding his decision to get the procedure was 100% because of Roe's fall. But Roe's demise isn't the only thing driving these men. Many of the patients filing in to see Guarin and Margaret Baum, the Planned Parenthood doctor he's partnered with, also talk about their financial worries. men who recently lost their jobs, small business owners without access to health insurance, and those who simply could not afford adding another member to their families. Gabe Meadows is a 42-year-old Republican from Ozark, Missouri, who owns a resurfacing company and an ATV dealership. Meadows believes there's just no possible way Biden won the 2020 election, and he hadn't heard of Dobbs until I brought it up. Minutes after Guarin performs his vasectomy, Meadows talks about why he was moved to act. He'd been needing a vasectomy for a while now, he says, because he has 7 children, but he had a fear of going to the doctor. I don't do flu shots. I don't do vaccines. I don't do anything like that, says Meadows as he recovers in a Planned Parenthood kitchen, a surgical mask pulled down on his chin. But then his mother and the paralegal assisting him with his own child custody case sent him a link to the free clinic at this staunchly pro-abortion rights organization that the GOP has long sought to defund. Meadows decided it was time. Not that I don't love my kids, Meadows says, but the time has come for those to quit coming. The first time that Guarin heard of a vasectomy, he was 11 years old. He was living in Bucaramanga, Colombia, growing up in a machista culture that delineated strict roles for men to fulfill and often excused the harm they caused others. And yet here was his mother, demanding that his father get sterilized. The context? He'd had a child with another woman. It really got my attention when I saw the reaction my father had, he tells me one evening on I-44, driving through the Ozark Plateau. It was a steep price to pay, but in exchange for meeting his daughter, his father was willing to swallow his masculine pride. I know this is going to sound graphic, but it was literally as if my mom grabbed him by the balls, Guarin said. His father got the vasectomy, and Guarin carried that exchange between his parents with him for the rest of his life, even after he came to the United States in 2003 when his wife, a microbiologist, took a job at the University of Maryland. Years later, the couple settled in Des Moines, where Guarin worked as a family practitioner. Some 2.5 years ago, when he was still working full-time as a family doctor and doing vasectomies on the side, he said he became aware that he had delivered babies from 5 women, and all of the children had the same father. Guarin had developed a rapport with the man, so he tried to persuade him to get a vasectomy. This is an option for you. Why don't you let me give you, literally, a worry-free sex pass, he recalls asking. But the man refused. There's something about masculinity that keeps men from getting a vasectomy, even if they want to. For centuries, many cultures have perpetuated the myth that being a man, a real man, requires competition and domination and sexual conquest. Some men incorrectly fear that a vasectomy will make them sexually dysfunctional or less of a man, and myths about the mechanics of the procedure abound. When Guarin decided to start performing vasectomies full-time, he wanted to make it as easy as possible for men to take this step. Instead of calling a medical office and scheduling an appointment with a receptionist, his patients could sign up online. Where other doctors charged north of $1,300 for the procedure out of pocket, he charged just $699. Insurance plans generally cover vasectomies, but they're not required to under federal law. And then came the mobile clinic. He got the idea from a 2017 trip with World Vasectomy Day, a nonprofit for which he serves on the medical advisory board. Traveling with the group to Mexico, he saw that the government used mobile clinics to reach rural populations where access to health care is limited. He said he became obsessed, deciding in summer 2020 to use his own funds to buy the trailer and the Ford F-150 that tows it, and set it up to be procedure ready. So far, his model has proved effective. He consistently fills his appointment slots when he's on the road for a week each month. Joplin's Planned Parenthood is a small, squat brick building with a used car dealership, a tanning salon, and a Baptist church nearby. as at other Planned Parenthood clinics, a blue sign with the words "Still Here" hangs next to the door. While Garin performs vasectomies in his mobile clinic, Baum is seeing another raft of men inside. Baum, who is a gynecologist and the medical director of Planned Parenthood of the St. Louis region in southwest Missouri, had been providing abortions in Missouri until June. These days, she and her patients have to cross the border into southern Illinois, where abortion is legal. But vasectomies, on the other hand, are readily available. So in 2021, Baum decided to learn how to perform vasectomies, partly because of the country's political climate, but also because she wanted to provide the full spectrum of family planning. In her view, it didn't make sense that half of the population got saddled with birth control while the other half didn't have to worry. So she reached out to the Midwest Access Project, an Illinois-based nonprofit that trains clinicians on how to provide reproductive health services. They put her in touch with Guarin, who traveled to Missouri to train Baum. By the end of the third day of this trip, the duo had completed 61 vasectomies. Guarin is exhausted, but he is not quite done. As he has every evening, he sanitizes his instruments, changes the paper on the examination table, lugs the sandbags that keep his promotional banners from flying away onto the bed of the truck, sprays disinfectant over all of the interior, and looks for a gas station to fill up his generators. Spanish and English songs softly seep out of a small Bluetooth speaker, from Mañas Mariposa Traicionera to AC/DC's "You Shook Me All Night Long." With every patient Guarin meets, he collects news stories of how men are wrestling with this decision. There's one story from Springfield, he says, that did more than teach him something. It broke his heart. A man came in with his wife. Guarin asked if the couple had any children. No, they didn't. All right, Guarin told them. If you're satisfied with where you're at, then it's no problem. Well, actually, we wanted to have children, the husband told him. But his wife had developed scar tissue in her womb from an infection, which heightened the risk of an ectopic pregnancy, a life-threatening and extremely painful condition where the fetus develops outside the uterus. Terminating the pregnancy is the only treatment. And while Missouri law makes an exception to its abortion ban for medical emergencies, many Missouri physicians worry that the language is too vague and puts patients with ectopic pregnancies and other life-threatening conditions at risk. What happens is that many, many, many hospitals don't know what to do with that, because that's terminating a pregnancy, so they don't want to be held liable for that, Guarin says. It was a hypothetical he'd considered before, but here was a real husband who had to get a vasectomy because of what six justices decided. That's exactly what was not considered before overturning Roe. It's not just black and white. There's a lot of gray. This was adapted from a story originally published by Politico. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The anchor who transformed television interviewing. Barbara Walters, 1929 to 2022. Barbara Walters made history in an industry dominated by male egos. The first woman to co-anchor a morning and an evening news show in the 1970s, the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning host was a master of the get, beating rivals to secure exclusive interviews with hundreds of leading politicians, entertainers, and other newsmakers, and tease out quotes that made headlines the next day. But the Boys Club of TV news reporting proved hostile. Walters had been working for NBC's Today Show for a decade when Frank McGee became an anchor in 1971, but he got the network to forbid her from participating in studio interviews until he had asked at least three questions. Well into the 1970s, I was completely unwelcome, Walters recalled in 2008. They didn't want a woman, and they didn't want me. Born in Boston, Walters was the daughter of a sometimes wealthy, sometimes bankrupt theater impresario, said the Washington Post, and shuttled between penthouses and cramped flats as a child. In the early 1950s, she found publicity work at NBC's New York City affiliate, whose manager schooled her in television production. She became the Today Show's token female newswriter in 1961. 3 years later, the morning program's Today Girl, usually an actress or model, suddenly quit, and Walters filled in. She gradually expanded the female turf, becoming the only woman reporter on the press flight for Richard Nixon's 1972 visit to China. Viewers liked her, said The Guardian, and television executives in turn liked the ratings. After McGee's death in 1974, Walters officially became co-anchor, a role she had been doing informally for years. 2 years later, ABC offered her a $5 million five-year contract to co-anchor the evening news with Harry Reasoner, making her the highest-paid news anchor in the country. Walters got an icy reception from Reasoner, a news veteran who considered her frivolous, said the Los Angeles Times. She coped by leaving the studio to become a globe-trotting interviewer, questioning Fidel Castro on a patrol boat in the Bay of Pigs, and scooping Walter Cronkite to get the Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin to appear together in 1977. But Walters would be best remembered for her primetime interview specials, said The Hollywood Reporter. Everyone from Bing Crosby to Monica Lewinsky sat for Walters, and her power to bring tears was legendary. The specials turned her into the epitome of the TV journalist as celebrity and a target of satire. Walters bristled when Gilda Radner lampooned her speech impediment as Baba Wawa on Saturday Night Live, and the infamous 1981 chat in which Walters asked Katharine Hepburn what kind of tree she'd want to become an enduring late-night punchline. Still, tens of millions tuned in. Walters scored another ratings triumph with The View in 1997, said the New York Times. On the all-woman talk show, which she created, she played peacemaker to the often fractious panel until her 2014 retirement. ABC named its news headquarters after her that year, at a ceremony attended by some of the female anchors and reporters who'd succeeded her. If I have a legacy, Walters said, I hope that I played a small role in paving the way for so many of you fabulous women. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page, starting with an article, Trump, A Slide into Irrelevance. One major political reality became clear during the disastrous House Speaker battle, said Charles M. Blow in the New York Times. Republicans are putting Donald Trump out to pasture. Facing multiple investigations and reeling from a staggering string of losses by his hand-picked candidates in the midterms, Trump suffered the public humiliation of seeing 20 far-right hardliners ignore his pleas to drop their opposition to Representative Kevin McCarthy. Vote for Kevin, close the deal, Trump beseeched the holdouts. But for days and multiple votes, they shrugged him off. Trump's hold on the GOP has been broken, said Charles Sykes in MSNBC.com. Rebel representatives Lauren Boebert and Matt Gaetz were his people, but said Trump was wrong to back McCarthy. Gaetz actually mocked the ex-president, cracking that choosing personnel wasn't always his strong suit. No Republican seemed afraid of him anymore. Why would they be, asked Olivia Nuzzi in New York Magazine. The former leader of the free world, 76, now lives like a retiree at Mar-a-Lago, adrift, bored, and craving attention, and fearing indictment and arrest. His nominal 2024 campaign is moribund and rudderless. Ivanka and Don Jr. were conspicuously absent from the launch. Celebrities and political allies have disappeared, replaced by QAnon believers and Holocaust deniers. Trump leaves the club only to play golf. His world is so small, said one advisor. To pass the hours, Trump obsessively watches Sunset Boulevard, the story of a silent film star driven to madness by her faded celebrity. In politics, you can have it so hot and it can go overnight, said an advisor. The magic is gone. Those who've longed to see Trump's demise may be denied full cathartic satisfaction, said Charlotte Kilpatrick in the New Republic. He may end up broken and forgotten, but his ideas are not going to die alongside him. Just look at the rebellion against McCarthy, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Of the 20 House members who held out, 12 are hardcore 2020 election deniers, and 17 were endorsed by Trump in the midterms. These are heirs to Trump's toxic legacy, those who learned from the master how to merge reality TV and grievance politics in pursuit of no higher end than owning the libs. They're the spoiled children of Trumpism, and like most ungrateful brats, now they've stopped listening to their befuddled old dad. COVID, what the virus is telling us. 3 years into the pandemic, the coronavirus continues to impress virologists with its swift evolution, said Carl Zimmer in the New York Times. The new Omicron subvariant, XBB.1.5, is the most transmissible version yet. It now accounts for more than a fourth of COVID cases nationwide and over 70% of cases in the Northeast. The subvariant's potent array of mutations enables it to better evade antibodies from prior infection and vaccination and attach to cells. After more than a month of holiday travel and indoor gatherings, COVID hospitalizations have increased 81% since Thanksgiving, with people aged 70 and over most likely to get seriously ill. The good news is that XBB.1.5 does not produce more serious illness, said Jacob Stern in The Atlantic. Vaccines and boosters still offer the best protection available. Masks still work. The bad news is that we'll be stuck in this COVID purgatory with a succession of new variants for the foreseeable future. The virus is talking to us, said Eric Topol in the Washington Post, and is warning us we cannot predict how it will evolve. That should be a wake-up call for the country to invest in new treatments and vaccines to block all coronavirus variants. Instead, we're barely using the resources we already have. Only about 15% of eligible people have gotten the new bivalent booster, including a mere 38% of adults 65 and up. People in that age group who received that booster are 80% less likely to be hospitalized, and early evidence shows that it can defend against XBB.1.5. It's obvious that we're all tired of the pandemic, but unfortunately, we're up against a force that isn't. To make matters worse, Congress has not stepped up, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Neither Congress nor the Biden administration rose to the occasion to create a national bipartisan commission on the pandemic. The recently passed $1.7 trillion omnibus spending bill includes creating a permanent office for pandemic preparedness, as well as funding for research. But we need more long-term vision. There are thousands of viruses in animals that could spread to humans, which is why we need a system of global genomic surveillance, an early warning radar for disease. Another pandemic could easily happen again, and soon. And we'll picks up some of the shorter notes. In the 2 years since the Capitol insurrection of January 6, 2021, the Justice Department has brought charges against more than 900 people involved in storming the Capitol, with a conviction rate of 99.8%. More than 180 of those charged have been sentenced to jail time. Teenage births have fallen by 77% since 1991, a plunge that's consistent across racial and geographic lines, and one that experts can't entirely explain. 3 decades ago, 25% of 15-year-old girls became mothers before turning 20. Today, just 6% do. Utah's Great Salt Lake could disappear within 5 years due to drought and overconsumption of its water, researchers warn in a new report. The lake has shrunk to just 37% of its former volume, with 60% of the lake bed currently exposed. We are in an all-hands-on-deck emergency, says the report, which calls on Utah and nearby states to cut use of the lake's water by up to half. Malaysian health officials who analyzed wastewater samples from 29 flights into Kuala Lumpur found that the coronavirus in 28 of them, with testing on the 29th sample still not completed. The samples suggest that on virtually every flight, one or more passengers is infected with COVID and can spread it to others. 48% on the poll watch, 48% of Republicans say the GOP-controlled House should prioritize working with President Biden and the Democrats, while 52% say they should focus on opposition. And we'll finish with a quote from Pele, who says, "I was born to play football, just like Beethoven was born to write music and Michelangelo was born to paint." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.